PE ends up becoming a tool of that system where we're going to make bodies cost less and then make them more productive because their minds will be better.
You're listening to Damn the Absolute, a podcast about our relationship to ideas. Produced by Eradicus. Here's your host, Jeffrey Howard.
Welcome, friends, philosophers, and fellow practitioners of ideas. This is episode 5 of Damn the Absolute. Theorists and activists argue that education is the bedrock of a democratic society. Having a well-educated citizenry is necessary for people to meet the demands required for democracies to thrive. In the United States, schooling is conceived of as one of the primary vehicles for educating these democratic citizens. For many of us who have gone through traditional schooling, physical education seems like an interruption in the school day, for better or for worse, but a distraction nonetheless from the rest of our more formal learning. Physical education conjures up a flurry of competitive sports, dodgeball, and fitness tests. Perhaps it also brings to mind anxieties around your own body composition and getting in shape, being physically fit or failing to be properly athletic. In part, this is the consequence of designing physical education with a very narrow focus on physical literacy, control, efficiency, and a commitment to a contextless ideal. It can also be the byproduct of larger cultural forces obsessed with profit margins, results, and the bottom line. Contrary to this viewpoint, some educators and scholars are pushing to make physical education a more prominent contributor to democratic living. Nate Babcock is an educator in Southern California. With 18 years' experience, he is centered on broadening our views of physical education, approaching it as a way of encouraging mobility, both physical and social, as well as encouraging democratic practices like cooperation, inclusion, dialogue, and collective exploration. How might concepts such as bodyfulness, corporeality, and phenomenology inform a more democratic approach to physical education? What might a more expansive and democratic view of physical education look like? And how do we enlarge conceptions of physical fitness to include how we interact with one another beyond the gym and the classroom and into our own communities? I hope you'll contribute to the conversation. Well, Nate, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Jeffrey. It's an honor to be here.
Yeah, I've been admiring your work from afar, and I'm excited to be able to dig in a little bit more into it with you.
I'm excited to attempt to make sense of all these things that I have in my mind here.
In Damn the Absolute fashion, I'd like to start out with this question. What is a viewpoint you've held in adulthood you were confident wouldn't change that ended up changing dramatically for you?
So it's a tricky one because it probably bridges, adolescence and adulthood. So I grew up around evangelical Christians and was myself one. And I don't know that I ever really thought that my faith would ever, like I never really said, this will never change. Like I will always believe this. I never really did that, I don't think. But I did believe it to be true. But as I've aged and studied and researched, you know, my belief has evolved quite a bit. So I would now not consider myself like a typical or traditional evangelical Christian. I would be more on the agnostic side, or I would probably situate myself squarely in the middle of being an agnostic. But I do hold the possibility of that sort of metaphysics being a possibility, but I don't think it's likely. I think it's a lot more complex than that.
Do you feel comfortable with the label of Christian in a very broad sense or God-fearing? I don't know what other term you want to use, but are there other terms you might feel comfortable with?
Agnostic would be the more accurate term for me. You know, I would definitely be sympathetic to something like Jesus's mission, especially seen from, let's say, the perspective of liberation theology or some of the process theologians like John Cobb Jr., you know, the Whiteheadians. If I were to lean in a Christian perspective at all, it would be, I would sympathize with those views. But yeah, I would definitely not be real comfortable with that that label of Christian, especially right now in terms of what you see with Christianity in America.
Yeah, it's, well, from my viewpoint, I would say it's a bit of a shame how much Christian has evolved because of the rise of the Christian right in the United States over the last few decades. So I think there are a lot who sit in that same camp with you. Nate, what is your background in education and what are you currently doing in the field of physical education?
So I have a bachelor's degree in kinesiology, and I have a teaching credential in physical education. And so I've been teaching roughly 20 years, about 18, 19 years, mostly or actually only at the elementary level. So grades 1 through 6. And I did coach high school basketball at the varsity level for almost 20 years also. So that was my initial background, was in coaching. I wanted to be like an NBA scout or an assistant coach and do player development stuff. I really enjoyed being on the floor, working with players and teaching. I've always enjoyed teaching. And I love basketball and the analytic side I like, you know, and the scouting side. And at some point I realized that a better life would be teaching and being married to my amazing wife. And I would have to sacrifice those things, I think, to be at the NBA level. And I did have a couple close calls, a couple opportunities to maybe work in the NBA, but luckily they didn't work out actually. So, but in physical education, what I do now is, so I teach every day and then I'm the lead teacher or the teacher lead, kind of like a mentor or a coach for our elementary PE program for our district, which is in Southern California. Mm-hmm. And then I work with some of the local colleges. I mentor student observers from the university that have to get meet these requirements for observation hours and things like that. So they'll come to my school and they'll watch. You know, I may speak at some conferences and often get invited to do things like guest lectures at other universities, maybe in different parts of the country or the world via Zoom or Skype or whatever. You know, I've been to China to teach out there for a little bit to teach their teachers. I've been to New Zealand to work with some people out there. So one of the weird kind of unique things that I do now is I don't publish anything really. I don't know that I have any sort of influence that you could ever look up and find anywhere, but I'm always in conversation with a lot of professors that are training future PE teachers. So they're called PEET scholars, physical education teacher education, right? So PEET scholars. So I have some interesting relationships with PEET professionals, PEET scholars. And so what I hope to do is to influence their thinking so that when they face their students who are going to be future teachers, they may hear my voice in the back of their head about some of these things that I talk about in, you know, on Twitter, my blog, which I'm sure we're going to get into here.
As you're trying to maybe incept the minds of some of these PEET scholars, what are some of the areas of disagreement you have or maybe pushback on ideas that you really care about and are trying to put out into the world?
So I think they're in a position where, because they're working with students who aim to get a credential, they have these requirements for credentialing, right? So a commission on credentialing, these, they have to meet these requirements. And so it's a very linear approach and, you know, very standards based. And here's how you have to do things. Here's how you have to do things. And so me coming in from a different perspective, I'll say, well, that's just one of the ways. It's not the only way. It's not the best way. And hopefully you get them out of that way soon. And matter of fact, I think it can be a really destructive way. And that's where maybe I get the pushback because, and for good reason in a sense, because I think what they're trying to do is, you know, quote unquote, equip their students with a method, with a tool set that they can use right away. And which I understand. The only problem is I don't know that there's enough critical engagement or interrogation of all the other things associated with the act and the art of teaching. And I think what students will do is they'll just kind of go through the process and not even really thinking a whole lot about it, but just under the impression that this is the way you do things and this is what a good teacher is. And they don't have that critical toolbox, those critical tools for questioning. And so rather than developing a specific set of techniques and tools for now, but also seen in the light of you're going to need to develop some other tools too. And always keep in mind here that context matters and culture matters and all these things. I just don't know that they get enough of that stuff. So whenever I'm pushing those things, I think the pushback tends to be something like, well, that may be too much for them. I think they need this thing instead. And so my viewpoint is, I think the first thing we need to do is ask them something like, what is education? What do you think it is? What is it for? And what is physical education? What do you think it's for? What should it be for? What do we mean by physical? I think if you start with that sort of interrogation in the beginning, I think rather than saying, here's the technique that you need to use, we could at least get to the point where we're going to say, here's the technique that is required to get your credential, but let's develop other techniques in the process as well. This is just one way, not the way.
Taking a step back to create this bigger picture, what is the foundation of your philosophy to education, and specifically physical education?
Let me just say that I think what education is, the practice of education, it's about this responding to the problems and possibilities of life in the pursuit of living well. I think that's what all organisms are trying to do. They aim to live well. Now, we can go down that road a little later, but education is a way of sort of developing these capabilities in order to respond to the problems and possibilities of life. So if it's formal education or public education, then, and specifically I'm talking about in societies that are explicitly oriented around democratic principles. If that's what we're talking about, then what education is in that sense, what public education in a democratic society should be in that sense is, or it should be about responding responsibly to the problems and possibilities of collective life, right? Of living together. And of course, everybody's trying to live well. And of course, we live together. So that's what education is for me, is it's ultimately about developing these capabilities, expanding these capacities for living well together. Now, if we want to talk about, well, what do you mean by living well? In this country, in the United States, I would go back to what the Declaration of Independence says in the preamble, where it ultimately announces that we're all equal in terms of our quest to be well. Right, we're endowed with these inalienable rights, you know, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, which, by the way, overlaps really neatly with Alfred North Whitehead's threefold urge, which he says all life has this threefold urge to live well, to live better. So everything's trying to creatively advance. It seeks novelty and it aims at the intensity of experience. And so the Declaration of Independence, when it talks about life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, I think it aligns really well with live well, to live better. So the way we do that, of course, in this country, or the way we're supposed to do this, what the Declaration of Independence says is, now, because we're all equal, we all have a say and we have to work together, right? The power of government comes from the consent of the governed. So we're all equals. We're all trying to be well. We have to figure out how to do this together. So school for me, that's where it begins. We're all trying to be well. We have to develop this ability to do this together. So that's, for me, I mean, it's trying to simplify it as much as possible. That's what school is for me, at least in this country, because that's what this country is supposed to be about. Now, going back to what physical education would be about the very same thing, but through this particular medium of the body, of the lived body, the relational body, through embodiment. So we essentially develop and cultivate these well-being or democratic, whatever capabilities you want to call them. We cultivate them through these embodied or corporeal or intercorporeal practices and exercises that we would do in PE.
When you talk about wellness or being well, in your mind, how many qualities or specific activities come to mind that are universal, and how much of that being well is really left up to the subject in the varied context they find themselves in? So this is sort of that question. Maybe it's relativistic, but I'm wondering which ones are more perennial and which ones are a bit more context specific to people, and what are concrete examples of that?
Right. So that's a great question, and it's really one that's hard to answer. I guess we would say that the ideal would be that we want people to be physically active. You don't want people to be too sedentary. But of course, there's a threshold for each person. It's different for each person, where too much physical activity or the wrong type of physical activity can be destructive. And so it's something that you're, that it's a lifelong process of learning, actually, is what practices and activities seem to contribute to my and your well-being, this personal, social, and ecological well-being. Which ones seem to do it the most? I would just say moving in a variety of different ways. Like a good example would be something like if you're able to walk or jog or run and then crawl and jump and land on balance and practice those things enough so that you're capable of doing them. And here's the thing, like in PE, what we really do a lot of is we practice skills, quote unquote skills, like throwing and kicking. And we're trying to get good at these things so that we could use them maybe now, but especially in the future, because we're supposed to be physically active the rest of our life. Like that's the dream of every PE teacher for their students, you know, be fit and be physically active because that's healthy for you. But for me, what I'm trying to do is just engage in all these different things so that students can develop a feel for what does actually work for them. So that's why I'm having such a hard time answering the question. Like I would say to you, it would be good to go run sometimes. It would be really good to walk daily, right? It would be really good to engage in a few mobility type exercises every day. It would be really good to do something like breathing exercises and check your posture and maybe some yoga and some strength related things. If you were to do those daily, maybe not too much, not too little, I think those are perennially kind of good, right? But it still mm-hmm. depends on the person and their context and what's meaningful for them. And so it's such a hard question to answer. So, but my role really is to explore all those different things and then get people to reflect on them and to notice, how does this make you feel? Did you like it? Did you not like it? Do you think this can help you? How do you think it can help you? Because we want to be realistic, you know, to look at it ideally and say, these are the things that you should be doing. I think it kind of dismisses the reality of that kid's context right now. And I want to work from that context, but I'm not in their context. So I have to blend with them and hopefully empower them to be as aware and, I mean, I would say as powerful as they can be in their context, right? To be as mobile from within their context as possible. And I don't just mean mobility in terms of movement. I just mean mobility in terms of just overall like embodied mobility and the ability to think differently, see differently, plan differently, move differently, all sorts of different ways of I guess, like what Spinoza would say, the ability to do and suffer many things. That's what I want to do in my class. We want to do and suffer many things and then allow them and partner with them to create meanings associated with those things. And any meaning they create is valid and it's legitimate and it's theirs, but it's for them to decide. So there are probably things that, yes, seem to be the best things that you can do, but it's still so contextual to me that I really have a hard time answering that question.
As someone who's many decades removed from my public education, especially in an elementary school. And even as a former educator, it's been several years since I've been in an educator position. But as I reflect on my experience, what you described as physical education, this very expansive view that's embodiment, doing no harm, its connection to democratic aims, feels very different from my experience. I think for a lot of people in the United States who've gone through a more traditional physical education, we think skills, competitive sports, dodgeball, things like that. How much have things changed from that? How common do you find your views on physical education resonate or manifest amongst other physical educators?
Well, I think things have changed. Especially in the last 10 years, I think the quote unquote field, you know, which involves a whole lot of difference, but I think it's getting better. As far as some of my views and how they resonate with others, I think they do resonate with others, but I think they still find it hard to envision how you can put it into practice. And part of that is my fault for not always giving enough concrete examples of how to do it. But the other reason for that is you have to do it within your context. I can't tell you necessarily how to do it. I can give you some ideas about what I do, but even what I do is still not great all the time. You know, there's a lot of stuff that I don't do well and things I need to do better, but that's part of the journey there. And as far as when it does resonate with people, does it ever gain any traction? You know, does it ever actually take effect anywhere? I don't know. And, you know, I was just talking about this with somebody the other day. So if somebody were to listen to me talk about all this stuff, and then say, okay, so what will change now as a result of me listening to this here? I think the first thing that would change is your reasons for doing it would change. And so your orientation toward the student and toward our medium, essentially, our embodiment, right, our corporeality, I think your orientation toward that would change. So that rather than saying you must be fit, you must be skilled, or you must do it like this, and you don't have a say because it's something you need, it's rather you would take a more empowering stance in a partner sort of relationship here. So we would now co-respond. And Tim Ingold is an anthropologist who refers to education as correspondence, which I really, really love. He juxtaposes that with hylomorphic logic, you know, this ideal form that you begin with, and we must mold it into this shape, which PE is totally guilty of doing that, right? Here's this shape. We're going to mold you in. We're going to shape you into that shape, actually. And mm-hmm. you're going to be in shape. You see that word show up all over the place in PE. Matter of fact, our national organization is called Shape America. So, which I do find to be problematic. But for me, I think what you do is you look at the students differently. They're not partners. They're not minions. They're not objects for you to control and direct and tell them what to do. It's now in the stuff that we do, they're now opportunities for transformation, opportunities to find and create more positive meanings and associations, to open up the world, to come into deeper relationship with self and other. That's where I think my philosophy would show up first in practice. From there, I think you would now be a little bit more empowered to co-design the experience better with students. Because I'm not coming in saying, do these things. I'm saying a little bit more like, reorient yourself. Now, because of your new orientation, you can go design these things and do these things. You'll do the right things because you'll do them with others. You'll take a more contextual approach. You will be a partner rather than a dictator. And so I don't know if my philosophy ever really gains any traction, but I do know that I hear back from a lot of people who will say, you know, you really got me thinking differently now. And essentially what they're telling me is that they think a lot more expansively and they do seem to take a more respectful approach to their students rather than dictating. It does seem to be more of a partnership kind of thing. And now what happens is difference is something to be embraced and welcomed, not something to be reduced.
In contrast with your own philosophy, what do you think are some of the prevailing ideas as to what the purposes of education are?
Right. So I've mentioned those already. It would be something like you need to be physically active your whole life. This is something you need to be. We want you to be physically active your whole life. And the reason why is because you need to be healthy. And so typically what we're working with is a narrow conception of health. You know, which is usually can usually be determined by looking at somebody's body. Now, I'm not saying this is all PE teachers. We're getting better at this, but I still think that's our go-to. I think we look at a person and determine whether or not they're healthy by judging their body. So I don't really like that conception of health because I think it doesn't include others. So we have this ideal form in mind. We want you to be healthy. And to be healthy, you need to move. You need to be physically active. So this entire project of physical education tends to begin with this future ideal form. And everybody needs to kind of meet that outcome, right? They need to agree to that outcome too, that goal, which of course they don't. And that's fine. That's good. And we will design everything so that we can get you there. We'll design all of these years of physical education schooling. We'll design everything around getting you there. So it's move to be fit to be healthy. Move to be fit to be healthy. That's typically the prevailing ideology. And this is because the prevailing notions of, let's say, physical or education or body are usually very narrowly conceived.
In your philosophy of physical education, you really push back against measurement, what you perceive to be like narrow focuses that are maybe imposed on others. And you also connect this to a critique you have saying that those are influences that come from neoliberal capitalism. I'm wondering if you could elaborate as to how you're conceiving of neoliberal capitalism and how exactly that informs or makes itself known in the classroom or a gym.
Well, I think a lot of these, let's say, narrow conceptions and some of our practices and habits within the field are there. You can trace the roots to something before neoliberal capitalism. I think neoliberal capitalism sort of reflects some of our human issues, right? But the way it shows up now in practice is with this fetishization of let's say data and measurement, things you can measure. Mm-hmm. So, you know, ambiguity does not work very well in something like neoliberal capitalism because it's all about the bottom line, right? It's about profit, let's say. The idea is to profit. And of course, you have to measure everything you want to. You need to create standards and you need to measure things against those standards and you want maximum efficiency. And so that shows up in our practice where we will now take a look at something like this ideal form. We've identified these goals and now we're going to implement some sort of linear process to make sure that these students, these objects meet these specifications. And then we're going to measure. We're going to measure with either fitness testing or we're going to measure with grades. And of course, one of the ways that we're going to get these grades is we're going to test them on something in class. We might test them on their run. How fast can they run a mile or something like this? And then socially or politically, one of the ways that we would test the success, the quote unquote success of something like PE, which PE is then seen, by the way, as like an intervention because socially, politically, we don't want bodies to be obese, right? Because they cost us more money. They're a burden on our pocketbooks, right? They're the cost of the healthcare cost, essentially, is something that we're told that we want to avoid. And so PE steps in and says, we'll address that. We will move kids. We'll positively affect their body composition. We will reduce obesity. So now what we've done is in order to save people money, right? The bottom line there, we now reduce the success of PE to something like steps, heart rate, body composition. Or, you know, the other phase of that is we've looked at PE or physical activity and we've said that, you know, physical activity, according to these studies, it positively influences academic scores or positively influences learning. And so, of course, in a school for jobs kind of system, anything that enhances quote unquote learning or test scores equates to something like economic success or economic superiority. Mm-hmm. And so we definitely value those things. So you could see where PE ends up becoming a tool of that system where we're going to make bodies cost less and then make them more productive because their minds will be better. They will be better academically. They will achieve academically better because we've moved them, which disregards the agency and the autonomy of the student, right? So to me, it's an anti-democratic approach.
What role might measurement or something like an assessment have in a philosophy of education that you're advocating? Because I'm guessing you're not about throwing out any sense of data or measurement, but what might be maybe a more democratic approach to measurement and data?
So it would be a lot more qualitative. It would be more cartography, let's say. So we can take inventory of the things that we can do. So I think it was Maxine Sheets Johnston, and I think she gets it from Merleau-Ponty, talking about the I cans, right? So we can take inventory of the I cans. We can also take inventory of the I can'ts, or I don't want to, or I want to someday, and we can chart progress. But this would be something that a student would do, and we would partner with them. You know, we could prompt them through quote unquote assignments or whatever, portfolios, journals. But we can chart progress. We can chart, you know, the evolution of their I cans. We can chart a potential future too. What is it that you would want to do? And then on top of that, we can have them, you know, assessment doesn't always have to be formal, of course. It can be informal where in the midst of what we're doing, we can ask them to reflect on it, to pay attention, to notice. What do you notice? What do you like? What do you not like? How did it feel when you did? Okay, now how do you think it felt to that person when you did? And when that person did this, how did you feel? We can still assess, but it's just we just use a lot more modalities, you know, multidimensional types of assessment rather than something so linear that gets reduced to a number. So rather than assessing for some sort of evidence of achievement or success, we are assessing for what you could call learning, right? Assessment for learning. But it would just be, to me, assessment is just another way of directing attention. It's another way of noticing. And then you build from there. And one of the things that you want to do is you want to be able to blend with the difference that you have in front of you. And so one size fits all approaches to assessment are not things that I'm interested in. I can definitely ask the whole class a question, ask them what they think and to reflect and fill out a journal or something. But I definitely don't want to reduce the success of those answers or those journals to like a narrow rubric or something like that. I just want to provoke and prompt reflection, dialogue, and noticing and attention. I want to direct attention to maybe places that they weren't going to direct their attention to. That's, for me, how I would use assessment.
So Nate, you talk about democratic ideals and aims and how they inform your work in the gym or in the classroom and physical education. In what ways do those manifest or inform in the community, democratic societies, and actually have an impact outside of the classroom? Perhaps I'm creating a false or unnecessary boundary between the two, but I'm curious what impact you've seen it have outside of the classroom.
So I think a couple of different things we could think about here. One is, so these practices that we engage in, right, these intracorporeal practices and exercises, and I love that word corporeal, right? And then the intra and the inter, because really that's what we're doing. We're coming into a deeper relationship with self and other, and of course, self in relation to other and other in relation to self. So even something like a handstand is just, it's like probing into self and the world. And it's developing a deeper connection with the ground and everything else around. So these are just ways of considering, right? That I love that term, consider, to be with something in a different way and to consider it and to be transformed by these embodied interactions. So when we do these practices in PE, I think what we're doing is we're deepening or heightening our sensitivity and responsivity to each other. One way of putting it is attunement through the body. That's one way you could see PE. You could frame it as attunement through the body. And so when I have this intimate contact with others, you know, via these practices, these meaningful, especially if they're meaningful democratic practices, through these dialogical practices, we sort of, especially in our subject, because it's so, of course, embodied, right? It's deeply embodied. It's very primal. No other subject really can facilitate these pretty intimate contact with others, whether that's the ground, a ball, or another human. And they're very intense practices too, you know, where we're competing in a sense, or cooperating and laughing or struggling. I think those kinds of opportunities, what they do is they facilitate the cultivation of this, like I've used the term before, bodyfulness. And Christine Caldwell has written a book on bodyfulness, but it facilitates enhanced bodyfulness. Now, the reason why that has implications for, let's say, democracy is that if you are more attuned, more aware to self and other, I think you see them as equals a little bit easier. I think you respect them more. You revere them a little bit more. And so Buber talks about the I-it versus I-thou orientation. Mm-hmm. And so for me, what we're doing when we're interacting with all these different others, we have the chance, especially if it's a meaningful, enjoyable experience, we have the chance to reorient ourselves to others from an I-it orientation to an I-thou. And so can you measure that in society? I don't know that you can measure that, but I think that that is part of its potential.
Hello, friends. Jeffrey here. Please go ahead, take a quick moment to click that subscribe button and rate us. It really helps us to further grow the community around Damn the Absolute. Enjoy the rest of the episode.
Okay, now here's a concrete example. In our class, we will talk about competition. So we don't take away competition. We will reframe competition. We will say competition is actually you versus yourself, and the opponent is your partner. And so when we play, when we compete, and especially when competing is like play, that's when it's at its best, it's most satisfying. This is the way when we compete, this is the way that we mm-hmm. celebrate each other. This is the way that we become each other, in a sense, that we engage in each other's growth. And so the ideal in a game, the best product, the best result would be the well-played game rather than a win, let's say. And so the point of playing is to play. The point of competing is that playful part of it, the doing, that sweet tension. Okay, that tension, that struggle, that's good. That's good. We want that. Obviously, if it's too much, it's counterproductive. That's why that sweet tension, that sweet spot, you want the right amount of tension. and I'm pushing you, you're pushing me, and we're equals. And I'm doing this for me, but I'm doing it for you too. And so we're doing it out of respect. And it's like communion. So it's the presentation of the challenge and the attempt to meet the challenge. That is the most satisfying part. Okay, here's a challenge. Let me meet this challenge. Now, whether you meet the challenge or not, it's okay. It doesn't matter. But of course, to us, it typically does matter. We get mad. We fight. You know, we treat everybody like crap the rest of the day because our team lost or my team lost or whatever. But that stuff, it doesn't matter. It's a game. It's sport. It is not life and death. When coaches make it life and death, that's ridiculous. It's not life and death. Okay? So what we're trying to do in our class is we will reframe it. You know, you play or you compete to play and to meet the challenge. And we both grow because of it. The well-played game is probably the best result we could have. Like, we've both enjoyed it. You came away with something. I came away with something. We celebrated each other. We loved each other. This was communion. Now, by talking about that in class, and we will actually look at videos and pictures and have discussions and look at these different examples and watch people pushing each other in competition and show it looks like they're against each other, but look, they're partners. They're partners. That's a way that we can reframe something like economic competitiveness. Like, why are we competing economically? Are we trying to overcome somebody? No, that's probably not the best way of thinking about competitiveness in that realm. And then so when we play games in the class, we can stop at any moment or after the fact and reflect, like, how was this like communion in a sense? What was the challenge? How did you meet the challenge? How did you treat your partner, you know, your opponent, but really your partner? And we can go and look and see how we embody those principles, let's say. And then, so when this spills out into the community and they play on their teams, you know, like, I'll ask students, you played a game this weekend, you're on a team. How did you make your opponent better? So I don't always ask them, I'll say, how was your game? Oh, it was great. We won. Hey, I don't care about if you win. I could care less if you win. Did you make your teammates better? Did you enjoy it? Did you make your opponent better? Did you respect your opponent? Did you respect the referee? Was it a well-played game? So I can constantly ask those questions. So now I'm reorienting them toward competition, toward a quote-unquote opponent. And just by reframing it, I'm hoping that spills out into the community. So when they play better. And when they coach better. And when they hear the adults in their life doing it the opposite way, they now at least have the possibility to have a critical gaze in that situation there. They could say, you know what, that adult, that doesn't seem right to me, because they could at least compare that approach with my approach. But we really try to really spend a lot of time on this topic so that it's not just me telling them. Like, this is me saying, look, based on what I've seen in my entire life of competing and what these people say who've won all these championships, they'll tell you the most satisfying experiences they've ever had in sports were not the wins. It were these types of experiences. That's what brings them back. So imagine if we focused more on these types of things and we welcomed this struggle and we saw the opponent as a partner rather than refusing to shake their hand before the game because your coach told them they were an enemy. They're a human just like you. And this is a way that we love each other. By reframing things like this too, what the hope is that, and when I get in the ear of adults in the community too that are coaching, like parents and stuff, what I'm hoping to do is make that youth sport more inclusive. Because if we're prioritizing competition in the way that it's typically framed, you know, we lose half the kids after a while because they lose the enjoyment of it. They're not playing it to win. They're playing it to play. They're playing it to be with each other. They're playing it to be tested. They don't know that they're playing it to be tested, but that's what brings you back. And so we just try to shine a light on that process. And now they have that little tool set that they can bring out into the community, hopefully. So that's just one example. I think that makes sense.
There are a lot of actors when it comes to education: parents, fellow educators, the students, administrators, scholars, education activists. Where do you receive the most pushback when it comes to this more expansive view of physical education that you're presenting?
I don't have a lot of these conversations with a lot of administrators. So don't really have that opportunity to get pushback from them, at least. And typically when I do have these conversations with them, I'll phrase it differently. And I think they support it, actually. I guess the pushback I'll get would be from people who have a stake in the way things typically are. You know, some physical educators or scholars that they might be kind of like PE celebrities, let's say, and they do think that, let's say, quality physical education or quality education is something a little bit more linear than I think it needs to be. And so they might fetishize things like standards and objectives and narrow framing of body, or a term like physical literacy or something like that, you know, where they might see the point of PE is to create these physically literate individuals. Like in the end, they'll become physically literate. I get pushback from people who believe those sorts of things, who see PE as a destination or a path toward a particular destination rather than a process of wayfaring and wayfinding that we partner students with. And for those who struggle with ambiguity, those are the ones that give me the most pushback.
You work primarily in elementary age, where the stakes, at least to me, and I could be wrong in framing this way, but the stakes seem not as high, whereas in a teenager high school level, the stakes seem to be a bit higher. And in that case, and when I reflect on my own time as an educator, it was often the parents who would give the most pushback or want to have their say as to how you're supposed to run your classroom and how you're supposed to be educating. So I'm wondering how much that informs there not being perhaps as much pushback on some of these ideas.
Yeah, I think that does. Now, parents at my school, because I have a pretty good relationship with students and the students love what we do for the most part, and they'll go home and tell their parents the things that we do. And so I don't have anybody ever really telling me from, you know, any parents saying, here's, you should be doing it like this, because I think the kids come home and say lots of good things about it. Now, the secondary level is different. I think when you get to the secondary levels, you can focus a little bit more. You can narrow, you can specialize a little bit, but I don't think that that should come from the teacher. I think that the teacher should be able to provide opportunities to specialize and narrow focus and to go into more depth. But I think that this either has to come in the form of electives or something like a hybrid model where students have choice within units or choice of units, and they have a little bit more leeway. They could negotiate within the curriculum a lot more at the secondary level. So one of the things that I think that you could really do at the secondary level is, especially let's say at the high school level when they're older, you could have a fitness class. You could have a dance class. You could have like if they don't want to play for the sports team at school, you know, if they're not an athlete at school, that you can have a PE class maybe where they play lots of sports and they like sports or something like that. But you could also have a form of high school PE that's just like elementary PE, where it's much more like game oriented, much more enjoyment oriented. I think a lot of kids at the high school level, once it becomes more of a thing, of course, right now, I don't think kids would just jump into it right now because they've probably come from all sorts of terrible experiences in PE. Mm-hmm. They're not ready to just jump in and say, yes, this will be great. But I think if we can slowly transform our practice, you can have high school PE like elementary PE, where kids are playing games, you know, where they get to choose the kind of games they want to play. And I don't just mean sports games. I mean games, fun games that involve like tag. Like, I think a lot of kids would love to play tag at the high school level, all the different varieties of tag or something like Bravehearts or Capture the Flag or something like that. I don't think you grow ever tired of those things, but it doesn't fit a model. It's not a sport. And so they don't play it at the high school level. And then you play softball for 4 weeks in a PE class and a lot of kids hate it. And then it's just, they just disengage and I don't blame them. So I think we do want to maybe specialize a little bit more and give them more of a say over the things that they would like to do at the secondary level. But I also think that we can still be like an elementary PE program at the high school level as well for the kids who want that.
You've mentioned a few influences on your thinking, including Whitehead. I think you mentioned Mary Lou Ponty. So I'm going to presume phenomenology has had some influence on you. Who are some other thinkers or schools of thought that have informed your overall philosophy of education?
So it's really interesting. You know, I never really studied much of education after college. I never really read any philosophy of education. I just spent a lot of time reading philosophy and other things that you might want to call philosophy, like psychology or whatever, complexity theory, all sorts of things. And those are the things that informed my teaching, my pedagogy, because it really shifted my worldview and then made me think of the world differently and think of people differently and agency and autonomy and all those things. Then later on, I was able to apply those things into my reading of philosophy of education and stuff like that. But so my biggest influences would be, you know, people like Whitehead, Bergson, all the process relational thinkers, Deleuze, and I know I mispronounced that, but Dewey, I love Dewey. So I guess, you know, so process relational philosophy, biosemiotics, new materialism, critical posthumanism, phenomenology, of course. Soma aesthetics is really, really important to me right now because I think that's what we do in PE. It's a somatic practice, a soma aesthetic practice that's body and feeling. And then just another person that I think is great is Mae Wan Ho. She was a theoretical physicist who was very much inspired by people like Bergson and Whitehead. And she has just written some amazing stuff. And she's the one who says that she talks about this notion of quantum coherence, which is really, really inspiring to me, which is you have this maximum local freedom and maximum global cohesion or maximum global coordination. And that, I think, is what we're all after. That's what I think organisms are after. That's what I think democracy is about. We want to maximize local freedom and this. We want to maximize cooperation. We want both. We don't want to erase difference. We want to enhance difference. We want, as Whitehead would say, this harmony of contrasts. We don't want to reduce the contrast. We want a harmony of contrast, but we want the difference to remain different. And we want each difference to enhance the other difference and not wipe it out. And so I think a coherent organism or a coherent society is very similar in that they're maximizing this local freedom of all the quote-unquote parts while at the same time maximizing cooperation and coordination.
Nate, it's been a pleasure talking with you on this, and I appreciate you offering a really refreshing philosophical take on physical education. I think a lot of us, too many of us, myself included, missed out on. So I appreciate the work you're doing and coming on and teaching us a bit more about it.
Well, hey, again, thanks for having me, Jeffrey. It's an honor.
Thank you for listening to Damn the Absolute. I hope you found our conversation worthwhile. We would love it if you could leave us a review wherever you listen to podcasts, whether that is Stitcher, iTunes, CastBox, or one of the many other options available to you. It goes a long way in helping us to build a community committed to fruitful ideas. See you next time.